This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The biggest issue facing Florida's healthcare system in the face of the coronavirus pandemic right now is a lack of protective equipment like masks, gowns, and gloves. Governor Ron DeSantis made the point at a media briefing in Orlando yesterday. He said the state has to make sure healthcare workers have protective equipment so that workers can continue caring for sick patients. And the director of the State Division of Emergency Management, Jared Moskowitz, said he's working to fill 5,000 requests from hospitals, healthcare facilities, and police and fire departments for protective equipment. So just how well prepared are frontline healthcare workers in the face of this evolving pandemic? Should Florida be braced for conditions like hospitals in parts of Europe and New York City are experiencing? We want to hear your comments and questions. Are you a first responder? Maybe you're on the front lines of this pandemic. What about businesses that have switched gears to make masks and other medical equipment? We're taking your calls. We're at 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. And we'll take your questions and comments over on Twitter as well. Our handle is at WMFE Orlando. Well, joining me for this show is 90.7 health reporter Abe Abariah. Thanks for being here, Abe.
Thank you.
Also with us this morning, Dr. Asim Jani. He is hospital epidemiologist with Orlando Health. Dr. Jani, thank you so much as well.
Thank you.
And Orlando Professional Firefighters Local 1365 President Ron Glass. Ron, thank you too.
Thank you for having me.
Abe, I want to start with you. You've been chatting with doctors, nurses, first responders, and hospital officials about the issue. Just lay it out simply for us. Do hospitals have enough equipment?
Well, as in many things in this scenario right now, the answer is a bit complicated. So when you talk to the hospitals themselves, they say, yes, we do have enough protective equipment at this point. We're not running out of things. At the same time, though, there are certain parts of that equipment that they are running into shortages on. So Orlando Health, for example, is one of the first ones to talk about openly, at least, that they do have a shortage of certain N95 masks, specifically the smaller masks, because this is obviously going to be a more common mask size. So they're not unique to having those kind of shortages, but they're kind of the first ones who are willing to talk about it. And, you know, this is kind of important because when you're talking about healthcare workers, they're dealing with a population that's going to be, you know, a sicker population, vulnerable.
Right.
So you don't want healthcare workers to become vectors themselves who are able to transmit it to people who are, you know, more vulnerable. And additionally, you know, right now, from what we know from the World Health Organization, you know, this virus is aerosolized. You know, it's not an airborne virus like measles where, you know, you can have someone who's infected with measles be in a room and 3 hours later, someone else can contract measles. That's an airborne virus. This is a droplet virus. So in that sense, you know, that's a good thing. It's not as contagious.
Right. And that means that having those masks is important, right? We also see what's happening in Spain right now. I mean, it was Italy before that. And now New York City, there's some pretty disturbing stories coming out of hospitals in parts of New York City where, you know, healthcare workers are having to improvise. They're seeing a real surge in patients. And the governor himself made the point yesterday, we really need to make sure that the folks on the front lines have the stuff they need, or that's going to create a kind of knock-on effect, a problem in itself, right?
Absolutely. You know, this is a group of people you don't want to get the virus for. You know, obviously you don't want healthcare workers to get sick. You don't want healthcare workers to die because then they can't treat people. But, you know, beyond that, you know, you really want to look at, you know, a healthcare workforce capacity issue. If you start having shortages in PPE and you start having people who are working in healthcare who are getting sick, who or are exposed to people who have end up being confirmed down the road to have COVID-19 and they don't have the proper protective equipment, you know, they haven't been treating them that way when they're on isolation because they're is a shortage of masks or any other equipment, then those people have to self-isolate, which then, you know, a healthcare protective equipment crisis can quickly evolve into a healthcare workforce shortage crisis, which, you know, there's been a lot of talk about how, you know, there's been a lot of talk about this being, you know, sort of a wartime against an invisible virus. And I think that's really important for people to kind of wrap their heads around, because when you talk about, you know, healthcare in wartime, you're talking about triage. And for most people, triage is you go into an emergency department. It's not first come, first serve. It's mm-hmm. the people who are the sickest that need the most help first get the care. Mm-hmm. But realistically, what you're talking about, healthcare, you know, despite what people may want, healthcare is a finite resource. It is an amount of equipment and people who are able to provide, you know, the highest level of services to people who are the sickest. And so when you start having, you know, shortages in that, then that healthcare resource becomes confined. And, you know, then you're going to have healthcare workers who are already making these decisions in places like New York, in places like Italy and Spain, where they're having to make decisions of, we do not have enough resources to treat everyone equally. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you're going to have to decide, you know, which people have the best likelihood of surviving this. And that those are the people who get the resources.
Right. And those are some pretty grim decisions for people in the healthcare field to be having to be making. I just want to hear a little bit of tape here, if I could. I'm sorry to stop you there, but you know, we are hearing from the state that they're kind of mobilizing resources, they're getting things in position. Here's what Jared Moskowitz, who's in charge of the Division of Emergency Management, was saying yesterday across the state.
We are starting to really turn the tide, get around the corner on getting this PPE in, get it out and rolling. We have over 5,000 mission requests, and those are being filled on an ongoing basis in conjunction with our partners at Florida Health, making sure, obviously, that we're serving the most critical needs first in hospitals and nursing homes and ALFs and first responders, obviously, that, you know, are running down to the last couple days of PPE. So we've ordered 7.8 million N95 masks. We've asked the federal government for 2 million from the Strategic National Stockpile. And thankfully, the federal government has pushed a good deal of product from the SNS here to help fill gaps until our vendors could start getting things in.
Right. So that's Jared Moskowitz there from the state of Florida talking about the request they're putting in. I mean, those are some pretty big numbers, right? 7 million masks requested and another sort of further two from the emergency stockpile. But the question, I guess, is, are those going to get here soon enough?
Well, you know, they're supposed to be here within the coming days and the coming weeks. And, you know, the question of whether or not it's soon enough is a bit difficult to answer, because we don't really know how many people are kind of coming through. You know, we know statewide we've got, you know, 2,300 plus cases of COVID-19 in the state. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the bigger question about the PPE issue is, you know, not just are we going to get it and when we're going to get it, but is it going to be distributed in a way that's going to benefit the places that have the biggest needs for it? Because mm-hmm. it's going to be very difficult to care for patients, you know, and they're going to start having to make decisions that are going to be difficult when it comes to this equipment, because it's not supposed to be reused, but there are going to come times where, you know, if you don't have enough equipment, they're going to be making some pretty tough decisions on the front lines.
Right. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 and 89.5. I'm Matthew Petty, talking to 90.7's health reporter Abe Abariah. We're discussing the need for personal protective equipment for frontline healthcare workers as hospitals and the like prepare for a potential surge in COVID-19 patients. I want to take your calls as well. If you have questions about COVID-19, the response in Central Florida, maybe the medical aspect of it, anything else, 1-866-338-5252 is the number to call. That's 1-866-338-5252. You can also reach out with your questions and comments on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. Ron Glass with the Firefighters Union here in Orlando, I want to put a question to you. What are you hearing from your members about the need for equipment? Because let's not forget, it's not just the folks in the hospital who are coming in contact with potentially infected patients. It's also people who may be responding to 911 calls, and I'm sure, you know, you see the paramedics out there with their gloves on a daily basis, but having to put a mask on as well is kind of new territory, right, for the firefighters and EMTs.
Yeah, it's something that we haven't had to experience in quite a while, Matt. At least not at this level. We have now taken the precautions. For us, it all starts with our dispatch center. The communication center takes the calls, and they do an advanced screening now. They ask questions as far as outside travel, any type of respiratory distress, questions that will give us a better idea of what type of personal protection we need to use when we respond to the call.
Mm-hmm.
most crews now are taking the approach of that all type of emergencies have the potential for it. So most everybody is wearing an N95 mask on these type of calls now.
Mm-hmm.
There's been no shortage within the Orlando Fire Department of it. At the beginning of last week, we had approximately 4,000 N95 masks in storage. We're supposed to be receiving, I believe, another 20,000 masks coming up this week. We ordered them this past week, and they're scheduled, I believe, for delivery on Monday. So there hasn't really been a question yet on PPE as far as having enough levels. Main things I hear from the members, my members, is coverage if they do become impacted by the illness. If they test positive, what type of coverage is out there available?
Mm-hmm.
But that is right now is probably one of the biggest concerns in all of the fire department right now.
Has anyone sort of raised the issue of, you know, what do I do if I don't just happen to have the equipment on hand? Am I within my rights to say, no, I'm not going to take this patient? Like, is that a conversation that's happening?
No, that hasn't happened at all. Fortunately, like I said, we've had plenty of masks, but ultimately we have a responsibility to the public to respond to them.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as our department continues to provide the proper equipment, which there's been no issue with, our job as firefighters is to respond when you call. So
right.
We have no choice. That's our duty. That's what we signed up for. So there's been no issues with that at all.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Asim Jani with Orlando Health, I want to bring this conversation to you now, and let me just come back to the idea of a medical surge, which clearly the state is putting some things in place for, and hospitals are planning individually as well. Sort of seeing what's coming out of New York City, does that make you a little bit nervous about what we might expect here in Central Florida, and particularly, you know, Orlando Health, which has a very big hospital in Orlando itself? Like, what are you braced for?
That's a great question. And in fact, I think all hospitals in Florida especially, but because of all the natural disasters that this state does face in general, and of course, after events like Pulse, where Orlando Regional Medical Center, you know, clearly had a leading role in that mass tragedy,
mm-hmm.
We are almost continuously in the process of trying to get our preparation, you know, efforts really streamlined, not only with sort of we consider standards, but especially to keep the community, to serve the community, keep the community safe. And in that light, your question is really important. I mean, when anyone, as a member of the public or the healthcare team, healthcare or sector, turns on the TV and reads the media reports that are coming out of New York or even prior to that, Washington State,
mm-hmm.
We are all on guard. It's a sobering thing to watch so many human beings and so many systems under so much stress.
Mm-hmm.
That said, so much of the actual fight is going on, especially as new numbers come in, right?
Right.
And that's really key. As more people get tested, more people get access to testing facilities, then that sort of helps define the picture. And yet it's only, in a sense, part of the numerator, because we know that probably there's a ratio, if you will, of all the people who are actually tested that many, many people in the community still have yet to be tested. There,
mm-hmm.
there are probably, certainly, there are cases of mild illness, you know, many-fold times the ones that you see showing up to hospitals. So we in response, you know, when we see things like that in New York, it basically emboldens us and quickens the pace on some things, trying mm-hmm. to do the best we can to make sure that we learn from those people's experiences, that we get out in front of this as much as we can.
Right. The testing issue is pretty critical, though, right? Because, I mean, it seems like there are many things we just don't understand fully about this this novel coronavirus, right? I mean, it's the pace of its spread, the kind of infection rate, the mortality rate of it as well. I've got a couple of questions here from a listener, Brandon, who writes in, when will we have enough tests to be able to randomly test to see where the community spread is? Or can we get the extra test to be able to do that? That's part one. And then he's also asking about posthumously testing people who've recently died from respiratory illness but didn't get tested. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on those two points, Dr. Jani. I mean, basically, Would you like to see more testing being done? Do we need to at this stage? And what about the idea of kind of retroactively trying to figure out if people who may have died from a respiratory illness that a physician put down to influenza, it turns out that was actually COVID-19?
Yeah, those are great questions. So it turns out that the appropriate focus has been, like we know from the time that really China started seeing their epidemics and many other countries, that testing, as it's been referred to continuously, has been in the context of detecting active viral particles, if you will, mm-hmm. that are present in people's secretions, right? And that's why testing is really, we're looking for the virus. And what's really important is that sort of both questions that the listener is asking are related to a core concept, which I'd like to bring forth. Number one, when we talk about population-based testing, especially in a communicable disease like this as a virus, by widespread testing that looks for the virus, we are only going to segment the individuals who are, one, symptomatic, and two, can access the healthcare systems and meet the criteria for testing. Mm-hmm. That is, of course, a smaller segment of the overall people if we consider at risk. There's actually more of an emphasis now at this stage, in addition to the testing for viral infection, which is critically important, and I think that needs to be continually scaled up. We're behind on that in general in the country, and people are aware of that. We're catching up. Mm-hmm. But really where I would like to see sort of the forefront is the testing research that's being done to determine an antibody test that really looks at another phase of this, which is not the virus itself, but what are people's immune systems doing?
Right.
And so we call that serology. And I would like to spend just a minute talking about that, because both of the questions that the listener is asking can be sort of contextualized. Number one, if we really want to segment the population, which I think people want to do, we want to find out what percent right now of the people in general, in their communities, have been infected and are mm-hmm. immune? Like, how many have recovered from it, right? Number two, what are the groups that are still at risk? And number three, how many might be incubating the virus, if you will, who might be asymptomatically infected and potentially could transmit the virus? Ironically, even though those are the most important questions, it turns out that the PCR testing that we are talking about on mass scale doesn't answer those questions. Hmm. It really is a separate one. And so I would like to think that once we have, and some reports are coming out that maybe in as short a time as 1 or 2 weeks, we might have some national level capacity to sort of test, to develop good tests for serology or the antibody. And once we get that in concert with the PCR or the viral testing, we'll have a much better handle on it. We might not need to posthumously look at people outside of autopsies, which are important and right. that would help the clinician understand disease process. But we really need to look at serology.
Mm-hmm. Listening to Dr. Asim Jani there, he's with Orlando Health. We're going to take more of your questions and comments too when we return to Intersection. You're listening to that on 90.7, 89.5, still to come. Continue that conversation about how healthcare workers and first responders are protecting themselves as COVID-19 cases increase in Florida. The number to call is 1-866-338-5252. You can also reach out to us on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. We'll be back after this. You're listening to Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking about the coronavirus, how it's affecting people on the front lines of the pandemic here in Florida. With me, 90.7 health reporter Abe Abariah, Dr. Asim Jani. He's a hospital epidemiologist with Orlando Health and Orlando Professional Firefighters Local 1365 President Ron Glass. You can join that conversation too, taking your comments and questions over on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. You can reach out to us by phone as well, 1-866-338-5252. Abe, I know you were going to make a point there for a moment, but I just want to come back to Ron Glass for a moment, because thinking about the folks who are eligible for testing you know, frontline responders are some of those, right? You don't have to be 65 and showing a fever to roll up to a drive-up testing site and take a test. I'm wondering if you're getting any feedback from your members about whether people are actually taking advantage of that, just to be sure.
To my knowledge, I've only had one member who's participated. I believe that happened yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Able to go up and get the test done. Unfortunately, just due to the style of testing that's out right now, it's a 3 to 5 day turnaround. So he's kind of in a wait and see status.
Right.
He's doing a self quarantine at home. So we're hoping. I know there's been talk. I think the FDA did approve a test that can give results back within a 45-minute time frame, but those tests aren't readily available right now.
Mm-hmm. Is that a concern, though, the idea that you might have maybe one firefighter in a firehouse who gets it, and then that's going to basically quarantine an entire, you know, crew? And it, like, are people concerned about having to put an extra shift or even where, you know, they might get some extra staff from to cover that?
Yeah, we've actually already been working on a mandatory overtime process if we do get to that point where we have that many firefighters quarantined. Last night we sent home a crew of, I believe it was three firefighters that had responded to a call several days ago. The initial tests for that patient came back as negative, but then we were notified yesterday that the test did come back positive.
Mm-hmm.
So those members sent home to self-quarantine. All the members that were involved, none of them had any signs or symptoms of the COVID or the virus. So right now it's just a self-quarantine status. We'll end up completing the 14-day period and then return back to work.
Right, because firefighters live in pretty close quarters, right? I mean, they sort of live together, they shop together, they spend long hours together in the firehouse. I'm wondering if any procedures might have been changed to try and, you know, make sure that there is limited spread if something does get into a fire crew.
Yeah, it's kind of limited to what we can do. I know we do a little more social distancing at this fire station. Usually at dinner time, it's a crowded dinner table. So we've kind of spread the tables out a little bit just to try and keep a little more space in it. But it is kind of limited to what we can do at the firehouse.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you got to remember, we actually spend one-third of our working life with each other. So we work a 24-hour shift. We're off for 48 hours. So one-third of our time is spent together with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So there's really limited to what we can do other than continue the PPE on the scenes, more frequent hand washing, and we are doing quite a bit more cleaning around the station. So there is at some point in the day, there's always somebody who's doing some type of cleaning in the station just to try and eliminate some of that hazard.
Right, and that's kind of a microcosm of what's going on, you know, across the entire country, the world. In fact, people are really trying to change their habits to slow the spread and flatten the curve, so to speak. Abe, thinking back to some of those questions we heard earlier from a listener about testing, you know, how it's been done now, what might happen in the future, and some of the serology that Dr. Jani was talking about. Your thoughts on that? What sort of stage are we at here in Florida, and what could change in the near future?
Well, I think it's important to point out that there's a little bit of mixed messaging when it comes to the testing right now. So I think that at the federal level and even at the state level, there's talk about how many, you know, testing kits are out there. And these are big numbers that are going out to people. And if you don't understand the context around them, it sounds like, okay, well, we've got millions of these tests that are available. So therefore, anyone who, you know, might be suffering from COVID-19, they're going to get tested. We know who they are. And then you can take those public health steps of, you know, taking that person, having them, you know, self-isolate and tracking their contacts and you know, doing those kind of things. I want to point out, you know, the Orlando Economic Partnership, which includes Daryl Toll, who's mm-hmm. the CEO of Advent Health. You know, he's one of the, you know, the high level people at the Orlando Economic Partnership. You know, they put out a statement about this. They actually said, you know, the public is hearing that testing is widely available. That simply is not true here in Central Florida and likely not true in many parts of the country. That is a direct quote. And I think that's important to understand, you know, when, you know, it is good that the CDC and the FDA are talking about having some tests that have quicker turnarounds. But at the same time, you know, when you're talking about the number of people who are coming through a hospital that are sick, that, you know, need advanced care, The testing for that is, if there's still a turnaround on it, even if it is just a 24 or 48 hour turnaround, you know, that can start to eat into that supply of protective equipment, because they do have to treat those patients as though they do have COVID-19 or they do have another respiratory illness. And right. So, you know, I think that's just an important thing for people to realize that, you know, we're hearing that the testing is out there and that some of these testing issues have been solved, but you know, the truth is that it's not that easy of an answer.
Got a question here. It's kind of a series of questions, in fact, from a listener, Jeanette Rivera, who writes in, are there people being treated for COVID-19 who have not been officially diagnosed because of scarcity of tests? And further to that, how busy are local ERs and hospitals? Are the official numbers an accurate reflection of what doctors are seeing in their hospitals? Dr. Jani, some perspective on that. What do you think about whether people might be being treated for stuff that they just haven't been able to test for? So it could be COVID-19, it might not be, but they're treating the symptoms anyway.
Sure. So unfortunately, you know, COVID-19 disease is occurring at a time when we're on the tail end of influenza. Seasonally, we also have circulating viruses, some of which are also coronaviruses, but those are causing upper respiratory infections in general, and they're very common. There are other viruses, of course, that cause respiratory disease, both upper and lower, i.e. pneumonia. So there are a number of viruses that are circulating. They all generally tend to present with symptoms that can confuse the patient, can mimic other diseases. And so it is a mixed bag. Mm-hmm. That said, let's compare and contrast influenza, for example, where we know that influenza is a very sort of predictable disease that has a seasonal pattern, both in the northern and the southern hemisphere. It's a disease which we also know is largely droplet and not necessarily aerosol generating in the same way that COVID-19 virus is. We also have a vaccine for it. We also have well-established antiviral medications. And we also know that the burden of disease is, quite frankly, orders of magnitude larger than COVID-19. And yet we've sort of, you know, accepted it as part of life because it has been around for so long. Yet we've had pandemics for influenza. COVID-19 is new. It's one of the three what we call zoonotic viruses, which were transmitted ultimately from animal to human, mm-hmm. Generally the reservoir being bats. And the first one was SARS. The second one was MERS. And these are acronyms pointing to different locations and types of syndromes. But essentially, these preceded COVID-19, and now this is the third animal origin virus, coronavirus.
Right.
We don't have a vaccine yet. We don't have treatments yet that are well established and approved. And so the point is that when you treat symptomatically, you're going to be fine. You're going to have to treat symptomatically, and those are fine. The issues are obviously much more pressing in the hospital setting when patients get so sick, like we're seeing in other countries, getting into ICU, getting you know, their death rates with this disease that are really alarming. And so that's where we need to try to understand from the larger picture where testing can help us. Mm-hmm. I will say that the question about that Abe brought up and very insightfully that clearly there may be mixed messaging, or at least the community is not getting a clear picture. Look, I think this is a consequence of something that really started probably in early January, mid-January, when many countries, including the United States, had some opportunities that it didn't necessarily go the way that they mm-hmm. they ought to have gone. And so we're behind testing. As we ramp up testing, we clearly want to get a much better picture of who's infected and who's at risk. But my prediction, if you will, I don't have a crystal ball, is that once we have a well-established antibody test that can differentiate those segments I talked about, that will actually help the viral testing be more strategic, because you will have immediately some sense there are vast segments of the population who don't have symptoms and actually you know that they've recovered or are already infected, you don't even have to test them.
Right, right.
And so that will sort of limit the number of people that need to be tested and perhaps matched with the available number of tests. Mm-hmm. That's a good thing. Mm-hmm. But the other thing that we can do and we should recognize in the hospital setting is that we can always help physicians. We're trying to do that. The CDC is coming up with materials. There are vast number of networks between different healthcare providers, infectious disease doctors, critical care doctors, nurses. You know, we're all on Facebook or social media. There's ways to sort of connect. And in fact, one of the things that we're working on is to try to help our clinicians increase the likelihood that their testing will be targeted to someone who really has the disease and not necessarily someone who has another disease that mimics the symptoms, right? Of COVID. And that can be another way to judiciously use resources and also isolate and use certain personal protective equipment more judiciously.
Got a question here coming in from JV. He writes, Orange County is telling me I need to have a slight temperature, some respiratory problems to get tested. I'm over 65 in cancer recovery. Cuomo, that's the governor of New York, said many tested positive for COVID-19 had no symptoms. Who's right, and can I get a test in Orlando? It's JV and Apopka. Thanks for writing in there. Abe, some clarification there. I mean, my understanding is that for the drive-up site, you have to actually be in one of those categories, high risk, you know, 65 and older, and displaying some symptoms. So what's the best advice to give for somebody in that situation, you know, cancer recovery, maybe other issues, and is worried about where they can get a test and whether they can get a test?
Well, there's a couple things to keep in mind with that. So the first thing is, you know, your best medical advice is not going to come from myself. It's not going to come from Governor Cuomo. It's going to come from, you know, a physician. So if you have a primary care provider, call that primary care provider. Don't go in unless you have to. You know, if you can call them, that's going to be the best way. If you don't have a, primary care provider, you can call the Florida Department of Health. And they do have a website and a phone number for that. It's 866-779-6121, 866-779-6121. But just more broadly, when it comes to this question of, you know, I want to test, I need to know if I have COVID-19. At this point, with the level of testing and the level of tests that we have available, you know, the reason that they're putting it towards these people who are in higher risk groups, you know, people who are healthcare providers and then people who are 65 and older who have some symptoms. The reason they want to test those people is because those people are high risk. So if you have someone who works in healthcare, you know, we've talked about this a little bit earlier in the show, but you don't want them to be able to, you know, spread it to a vulnerable population while working in a hospital or working in an assisted living facility, nursing home, something to that effect. You don't want that to happen. Same thing if you are someone who's 65 and older and you are at a higher risk of dying from COVID-19. They want to know early so they can keep an eye on you and they can check in. More broadly than that, you know, if you are someone who, you know, is at home and, you know, may be sick and may be worried that, well, do I have COVID-19 or do I have a flu? Do I have something else? Until you get to a point where you need to access healthcare services, you know, the same sort of criteria applies. You know, you want to stay at home, you want to isolate from, you know, loved ones and people around you as best you can. You know, we've seen this already with, you know, people who, you know, we've had examples on NPR where people are healthcare providers, it's two healthcare providers in a household, you know, and they're quarantining in different parts of the house because they're dealing with COVID-19 patients. You know, so this virus spreads in close contact more than some of the other viruses we've seen. It's really difficult for, you know, a lot of the cases we've seen, you know, once you have someone who has it, they're spreading it to the people that are in close proximity. So you want to be able to shut that down as best you can. But until you need medical help, until you need, you know, if you're having trouble breathing or, you know, some of these other symptoms, you know, your best bet is to try and stay away from the healthcare system as best you can. And that's not just for the healthcare system. you know, you obviously you don't want to overburden the healthcare system, you know, if you can avoid it. But just as importantly, if you don't have COVID-19, if you have something else and you're able to deal with it, you know, just sort of treating the symptoms at home and sort of dealing with, you know, a fever and cough at mm-hmm. home, then you're not going to be putting yourself at risk to getting exposed to it by going out into these healthcare settings, because healthcare settings, unfortunately, studies have shown over and over again, are a source where people are going to come in contact with something like COVID-19, especially COVID-19, because we don't have, you know, a lot of herd immunity to it, because it is a new virus coming from, you know, animals that, right. that has made that jump.
Right. And no vaccine just yet.
I think we should jump to the doctor as well on this as well.
We'll pick that up after the break. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 and 89.5. Continue that conversation in a minute about how healthcare workers and first responders are protecting themselves as COVID-19 cases increase in Florida. We're taking your calls too. You can chime in at 1-866-338-5252. Reach out to us with your comments and questions on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. We're back in a minute. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 and 89.5. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking about coronavirus, how it's affecting people on the front lines of the pandemic in Florida. With me, our 90.7 health reporter, Abe Abaraya, Dr. Asim Jani, hospital epidemiologist with Orlando Health, and Orlando professional firefighters, local 1365 president, Ron Glass. You can join the conversation. We're at 1-866-338-5252. Comments and questions are welcome on Twitter as well at WMFE Orlando. Dr. Jani, sort of thinking about this from an epidemiological perspective, you've done some work on H5N1. I might have got those numbers around the wrong way, but previous epidemics. And we're seeing kind of the county response, the local response sort of leading the charge. Is that the best way to tackle this in a country like the United States?
Well, first of all, the United States, you know, like any other country, has its unique features. We certainly do have a large and strong overall public health system. We don't have a Ministry of Health in that sense. We have 50 different sort of jurisdiction states in terms of commonwealth and, you know, ideas of how public health recommendations can be translated. But fortunately, we have actual or potential. We have this platform of the federal government working closely with its own agencies and public health departments at the state and local and county level that sort of follow a general guidance and try to translate science into the best practice possible. I think that our health systems and our public health systems, we need to always be mindful. The public needs to know that they have an active part in helping these health systems work better. Not only are they, many of them, operating on the basis of tax dollars, so they're invested in that way, but as part of these agencies that really serve us, we can be more mindful consumers. And what I mean by that is that our specific choices in terms of what we do at the community level, how we advocate, how we vote, do we vote? All of those things do translate and come back to serve the community. In that light, I want to just sort of dovetail onto what Abe was saying earlier, that, you know, this particular virus clearly has some patterns to it. And when it comes down to these risk groups and people trying to get tests, I just do want to say that from an epidemiologic point of view, we have to constantly learn about what this virus is teaching us. We know that in the Asian countries and in our countries, partners, that the demographics were of a certain pattern. Here, from the CDC report that recently came out, as well as anecdotally, you turn on the news, you hear different experts, especially in New York, you realize, wait a minute, maybe we're seeing different things. Maybe we're seeing more atypical presentations involving the gastrointestinal tract. Maybe we're seeing younger patients. Maybe younger patients who are actually getting sicker and going into respiratory failure, maybe more of them than in other countries. And so why is that? And part of that is explained on the basis that our population has challenges with chronic metabolic disease and obesity and those kinds of conditions, which are chronic comorbid or concurrent diseases that put us at risk for sort of getting into trouble with this virus. So I think that as we know these criteria, this over 65, we keep hearing it, but I would not be surprised if in the next few weeks, because our patterns are different, that people who are in younger age groups and who have more defined chronic illnesses may in fact be eligible, quote, for testing in the same way that you see. I do think ultimately the medical care sector, where health provider and patient sort of interact and work it out, that's the best place. But that still, we should not forget about the millions and millions of Americans in this country who are underinsured, uninsured, and who often have very difficult time getting access to health care, let alone testing of this type. So I think that really the way I look at it, I'll just back up and kind of the last comment on this, is that COVID-19 is a disease that is like HIV, you know, 30 years ago, which is going to shed light on many, many aspects of our society and our systems and even our own individual behaviors that are opportunities for us to improve. It will shed light on those things that are not working well to get us to work well.
Right. I want to just kind of come back to this notion of trying to flatten the curve and slow the spread of this disease. The message we've been hearing, at least from county and city leaders here in Central Florida, and I know that our health reporter, Abe, you spoke to a Winter Park physician about many things, in fact, about personal protective equipment, but also about this notion of just trying to make sure there isn't too much of a strain on the hospital system. Let's just hear a little bit of your conversation with Dr. Amy Worley.
But we need to slow it down and do that slowly over the next several months rather than all at once in the next 2 to 3 weeks. If we get to a point where everybody is getting sick and showing up at the hospital at the same time, we will be no different than Italy right now, who's having to decide which of the two patients in front of them they're going to give the respirator to and which of them they're going to let die. And that's absolutely tragic. So social distancing is critical right now. I've seen people going out to eat. I've seen people calling to make general appointments to, you know, get their tubes tied. I've seen people get upset that I haven't, you know, let in their entire family to see the ultrasound of the baby. But people need to understand the reason that we're doing all of this. Yes, it's inconvenient to have a curfew. Yes, it's inconvenient to be placed on lockdown. Yes, the economic burden of this is significant, and it will take years to overcome. But the alternative is an enormous amount of loss of life, and that's not worth it.
So, Abe, that was Dr. Amy Worley, physician in Winter Park. Some sobering thoughts there, really sort of putting that in perspective. This is obviously a conversation that a lot of healthcare workers are kind of having amongst themselves and also trying to get that message out to the public. What are you hearing? Abe, you still with us? We might have lost Abe for a moment there. Well, let me come back to you, Dr. Jani, then. I mean, sort of thinking about those kind of conundrums that that healthcare professionals are facing, that's a challenge, right? I mean, that's something that no healthcare worker wants to be put in that position, right? Sort of having to decide how to use scarce resources, and clearly efforts are being made to make sure that those resources are in place. But there's a role for the public to play here too in terms of following directions about how to try and cut down the spread, at least, of COVID-19.
Absolutely. So for the listeners, I think educating ourselves, listening and learning about the guidance that's coming down, about what I refer to not as social distancing, I like the term physical distancing, because social distancing has a sort of alienating effect or an import to it. And
sure.
So I do think that physical distancing is really what we're trying to achieve. But then also, when required, changing our behaviors, you know, making sure that we're more conscious about the absolute basics washing our hands, not touching our face, staying at least 3 to 6 feet away from people who we think might be sick, not being in crowded places, not going to mass gatherings and trying to figure out ways in which our meetings can be reformatted. All those things are important. I think that physicians and nurses who are on the front lines would have major dilemmas and challenges when, in fact, they are faced with those kinds of almost ethical issues. But fortunately, here in Central Florida, and I think even elsewhere, as the system gets strained, more and more resources are going to, I think, ultimately be mobilized. I think people are not necessarily on a widespread basis having to face those types of situations. I think working harder is great, but I always tell people, my residents, my fellows, work smarter, not harder. The important thing is that this is truly sort of a marathon. We do not know when ultimately we will be able to look back in the rearview mirror and say we're done with COVID-19. It may be a matter of weeks, if not months. And so clearly, we need to understand that everyone has a role in flattening the curve. I completely agree with the physician who said that just because mass testing is made available and that too rapidly, that we try to make the message everyone gets tested for virus all of a sudden, it might, in fact, very well could overwhelm the healthcare system. But that said, I think that as I come back, you know, other tests are going to be, I think, available. They will give us a more rational approach to testing for the virus. And I think we're going to get through this if we just all work together and keep our social lens in mind.
Yeah, interesting points there. Ron Glass with the Firefighters Union here in Orlando. I know, you know, the city of Orlando clearly has been through a lot in recent years, right? And people talk about the Pulse tragedy and how, you know, we will get through this this time of strife as well. But I'm wondering, I mean, does in general, do EMTs, firefighters kind of think about pandemics in their planning for mass events? Or is this something that's caught people a little bit on the hop?
I think your ordinary firefighter doesn't really look at it as much. I mean, we have some specialists, the firefighters that deal with a lot of hazmat situations. They constantly keep up to date on these type of incidents. So it's something that's newer for just your general firefighter, but our specialized people have definitely been on top of this for a while now.
Mm-hmm. And there was some training kind of done to make sure that firefighters, you know what to do, that the steps you guys need to take when out on calls, right, to make sure you aren't putting yourselves at risk.
Correct. There was also just a email training and also video training that was sent out to the members, just proper donning of PPE, proper call taking for our communication specialists, so they can give us a heads up that it is this type of response that we're responding to. We've changed the exposure level for some of our members, whereas before we would get called to a house, we would go inside the house, all members of the crew would go inside to begin treating the patient. Now we're taking an attempt to put less people inside the house, and in fact, we're asking the patients that we run on, if they're able to walk outside of the house and meet us out front. Mm-hmm. So put a little bit of a less of exposure, and then we're trying to limit the number of people that are also treating that particular patient if needed. Obviously, if it's a cardiac arrest where it's all hands on, then obviously all of our responders will be there treating the patient. But if it's something simple as dealing with flu-like symptoms, then we try and let one or two people handle that patient care.
What about things like kind of swabbing down gurneys or making sure that there's, you know, like, are you even able to sort of decontaminate that stuff, or is that just too a bridge too far?
Well, we've got a couple different ways we can decontaminate it. All the units are keeping a bleach solution on that we're using to wipe down. We also have an aeroclave system, which is designed to decontaminate larger capacity vehicles like a rescue, mm-hmm. Which we do our transports in. So we have that at Station 1 as an aeroclave. We also have a second one on order. Each unit is doing that every Sunday. Every rescue truck is going down there. And then any type of call where they have that type of response that it's a possible mm-hmm. COVID-19 call, they go down to Station 1 and use the aeroclaves. And that aeroclave is also available at some of the local hospitals, so they can also do it there immediately after offloading the patient at the hospital. They can aeroclave and decontaminate the unit there.
And just real quick, in the last sort of few seconds we have here, Ron Glass, I mean, we heard from Orange County Sheriff John Mina a few days ago that the impact of the curfew was kind of cutting down on 911 calls. I'm wondering if you're seeing a difference in 911 calls. Are you getting more calls for respiratory type things?
We are getting more that are related to that. I know I worked last night, and it seemed like the downtown units weren't as busy as they have been over the prior couple months. Obviously, with all the bars and restaurants shutting down downtown, our responses downtown have limited. But they are seem to be more of these type of calls now that's what people are calling for. And we encourage, as long as you're having the respiratory effects of it, to call 911, and we'll come out and transport you. But if you're having just dealing with flu-like symptoms without any type of respiratory compromise, then keep self-quarantined at home rather than call 911 and have to be transported to the hospital.
Ron Glass is the Orlando Professional Firefighters Local 1365 president. Thank you so much, Ron.
Thank you very much.
We're also joined by Dr. Asim Jani. He's hospital epidemiologist with Orlando Health. Dr. Jani, thank you as well.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.
And we also heard from 90.7's health reporter, Abe Abariah. Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Monica Seely. Production assistance for today's show from Mac Dula and Steve Yasko. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast. Check us out online as well, wmfe.org. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.